What's going on, everybody? Welcome back to My Social Life. This is the podcast where you can hear the stories behind the people on social media. I'm your host, Jacob Kelly. As always, today's podcast is powered by TrueFan. And today is an episode of The Social Report. And The Social Report is a monthly episode in conjunction with TrueFan, where we sit down and break down some of the most interesting influencer marketing and social media news from the last 30 days. As always, today, I am joined by TrueFan CMO, Karen O'Brien, and TrueFan advisor, Scott Birdie. Welcome back to the podcast.
Happy to be here.
Thanks, Jacob.
Where I want to start today, and you know, we were just kind of chatting a little bit off air about all the social networks copying each other, and we're going to bring that up again later in the podcast. But where I want to start is with Twitter acquiring a company called Threader. And essentially what Threader was prior to the acquisition, and I used it all the time, it allows you to find like those long threads on Twitter where it's like 20, 30 threads, and you could just reply and tag at Threader app. And as long as you just wrote unroll, U-N-R-O-L-L, it would create a web page for that thread. So it would take the thread, it would take all the text, and would basically turn it into a little blog post that you could read. And so I would save that to my blog post app that I used to keep track of all the blog posts I want to read, so I could kind of mark them as read later, essentially. That's what Threader was. It allowed you to turn Twitter threads into little mini blog posts. And so Twitter actually just acquired Threader, and they're rolling it into Twitter Blue, which is their $2.99 a month subscription version of Twitter. So it's a new feature that Twitter is rolling into Twitter Blue now. But what I wanted to talk about with this is we've talked about it. It's been a constant theme how all the social networks just copy each other. And like I said, we're going to talk about it later in this episode. But I thought this was an interesting way to look at innovating on social, is letting your community build on top of your network and then acquire the top performing products to roll into your own social network and allow the community to kind of spearhead the innovation, and you take what works and put it in your product. And like Twitter's been doing this, like they just acquired Revue, which is their newsletter platform. And now they have like a newsletter opt-in right on Twitter for some bigger creators. They acquired Breaker, which according to TechCrunch laid the foundation for Twitter Spaces. And even last month they acquired Sphere, which is a group chat app. So I'm assuming that's going to be coming to Twitter in the future. So now it looks like Twitter is using acquisitions to innovate, and acquisitions based on like that the community has spearheaded, as opposed to just looking at what Instagram and TikTok are doing and try to roll that into Twitter. So I'm curious what you think of that approach when it comes to innovating on social, as opposed to just the copycat method.
Me personally, I just feel, for example, like Twitter just launching live shopping makes no sense to me. But that's because I think of Twitter as being much more around like the water cooler conversation and news and more serious kind of topics than maybe TikTok, for example. And so I don't think about shopping on there. The latest announcement that they put out showing sort of the live stream and their first test that they're doing with Walmart seemed especially kind of not relatable to me, because I wouldn't think about shopping for Walmart products on Twitter. I could see perhaps maybe paying for news subscriptions, paywalls for content that I wanted to read. Maybe even some of the products that are really kind of Twitter iconic, like Wendy's, Slim Jims, and others. Like maybe I could see doing some sort of, you know, purchase with them, but I just don't see like mass consumer products. But maybe that's just me. I don't know, Scott. What do you think?
Yeah, I pretty much am on the same opinion as you. Like I just think about like most of our audience, it seems like we've talked about a little bit before of like, hey, like they have wider audiences that kind of bleed into some of those other, I would say, main social platforms at this point. Not that Twitter isn't, it's just kind of like, you know, behind some of the TikToks and the Instagrams of the world. But for things like, yeah, I think about like investing, finance community is there, like crypto community is there, gaming community is there. Yeah, exactly. But like the, you know, sort of purchasing or the power on the side of like finances from each of those groups, I think it gets like spent elsewhere. Like, I mean, for example, Twitch already has a number of ways you can support streamers and the people that like you would be interested in supporting. And I feel like the actual brands on there are probably going to do better through a really unique activation or promotion through Twitch than it would be on like a very kind of what's seemingly like a static or slightly boring way of shopping on Twitter. It's just kind of like a live feed. It feels almost like when Facebook came out with Lives and people were just kind of standing there and some iterated version of that. So yeah, I don't really understand it, but I'm sure there's, you know, a reason for it, I suppose, and potentially that's just competition. But yeah, looking at that Walmart example, I thought the quote was so funny. It's like the CMO making it sound like they've been like behind the scenes talking about how to meet these rambunctious like Walmart consumers where they are online. And it's like, what? Like, you have hundreds of thousands of followers on Twitter that don't go shop in your stores? Like, I don't get the like value proposition here. Like, wouldn't you rather go shop in a Walmart than buy a few of those products online, like you just said, Karen?
I could see that Twitter, you know, the sort of payments on Twitter, for example, might be useful for, you know, rewarding journalists or bloggers that you follow. I could see that, you know, for more sort of independent journalism.
Like, was that the tip jar? Or
mm-hmm. Yeah, like I could see that. But I just, yeah, I don't get it.
Yeah. Cause that live selling very much feels like a, oh my goodness, TikTok has live selling, Instagram has live selling, Amazon has live selling. We need to get in this. So it's like, I think kind of the point I guess I was trying to make was that innovate for your community and what your community needs. Like listen to your community instead of listening to your competition. And then you can create a more tailored product for your users. And the more they become power users, the more they're going to invite more people to the network. And you know what I mean? Like, it's just, the copycat thing just feels like, oh my goodness, this is popular over there, but it might be two completely different platforms. So it's like LinkedIn rolling out stories. Like, I don't know if that is that a LinkedIn. I don't know if that's like LinkedIn's audience, right? But I'm sure there's other features that the LinkedIn audience would love to have on top of stories. It feels like the prioritization is just out of whack in terms of what you choose to enroll into the product versus what you choose to leave out.
I mean, to Twitter's credit, maybe they're trying to move even further away from politics on the platform.
And I feel like for so many years, Twitter was the platform that people always dunked on for not innovating. For it was just like the same product for like 5 years and nothing happened. And now they're just like anything and everything. They're like throwing in the platform over these last 18 months to see what sticks. I mean, it's great. Like, they've rolled out Fleet, a bunch of stuff that we've talked about on this show. But it's just like for so long, it was just the same app. And now they're just innovating at a rapid rate.
I think to your point, like the community driven innovation is basically just another model that's been used in SaaS and like maybe not so much applied to like the social media world as it stands today, because like usually you have to get to a certain point before you kind of like gain the eyeballs of like an Instagram for acquisition or whatever have you, like Facebook or whatnot. But I think there's a lot of like weight to that. I mean, you look at Shopify, you know, like they have probably acquired, I don't really know the number, but somewhere in the range of 100 plus different companies that probably came up through their app store, I think it is, or like whatever they offer. And yeah, I'm sure that like, I guess like what I'm thinking about is maybe what they're trying to do when they're launching some of these types of things that don't make as much sense to us, like shopping, for example, is kind of like, okay, we have this like more strategic side to our innovation that's like focused on like deeper ways that people are getting value out of Twitter that we can't really like roll into our core product as of now. But if we go even wider and we start like competing as well with some of those other new features that are coming out on the different socials, maybe our community will at least start talking about it and kind of like show us where we need to go. And so like, I was just thinking of that because when you describe LinkedIn as another example of like, hey, we just started, all of a sudden LinkedIn comes out with stories and like people are like, well, I'm not going to recycle my Instagram stories onto LinkedIn. That's probably not going to work too well, right? It's like, it's not the same community. Probably not the same type of stories that are going down. But by doing that, maybe they got to a point where it was like, they noticed that their community on LinkedIn was a bit more responsive to that tool as a way to like create a front end of their profile and like have something that people could click on to like have a more personable intro. Cause I see a lot of people seemingly using that feature, which is kind of just like a jump from the story feature or like a saved version of a story, right?
Arguably the most desired feature on Twitter still isn't really there, right? Which is the ability to edit your tweet.
Oh my God, yeah.
Right? Like, that to me is such an obvious community-driven desired feature. Like, why would you roll out something like shopping before you would actually give your community what they're asking for?
I think they might have actually, I'm just Googling this right now, they might have rolled that out for users of their subscription. I think like you have in the first couple minutes. I could be wrong. I'm okay. Just checking that right
what
now.
I thought they did though was they rolled out something where you could basically control who responds to your tweet. So in other words, like you can't actually edit your tweet, but you can, you know, if you put something inflammatory out there and you're getting trolled, that you can then like control who responds to it.
So essentially, they don't have the edit, but they have the undo tweet function for Twitter Blue users. Okay. So you can, if as like there's a buffer before your tweet goes live. So if you can catch it, you can hit undo and correct your typo or whatever it might be. Still not edit, but it gives you a little bit of time to check it before it fully goes live. But that's another thing I wanted to ask you about too, with especially with Twitter Blue. It feels like a lot of, not all of them, but some of these new innovations that Twitter's rolling out is only available to their subscribing users. So is that a good move to make it more desirable to try and get people to pay for it? Or should you be trying to make the platform as awesome as possible for every user?
I think while we could have like opinions on whether that's good or bad, I think it's probably more of a calculated move on their end. Like one, they need to monetize more. They need to please shareholders. There's like kind of like these like traditional outcomes that a business needs, especially when publicly traded. And I don't know, I take a look at like myself again, or like think about our marketers that we know, like the marketing world out there. When I look at like information sources, I'm actually kind of okay. Like I'm on the wall a lot of the time on whether or not I actually like purchase, but like if we're talking $5 or under on the subscription side, I tend to jump if I find it for a piece of information that I really want to read. And then, you know, it could be months before I unsubscribe or actually get around to thinking about like how many of these have I signed up for. And so like, I don't know if there was enough kind of like both combination of information that was kind of unique or exclusive, you know, kind of walled, if you will, and features that were wanted. Maybe it's like actually becomes a useful tool. There are a lot of marketers, come to think of it, who still rely on Twitter for information and use it to kind of connect with like-minded peers and such. So yeah, I don't know. I like, what is it? $2.50 a month or something like that?
Like $3, I think. Yeah.
It's on the low end. Like Business Insider costs like $1 a month, and that's a pretty crappy blog, but comes out with some decent information now and then.
Fair enough. It's going to be interesting. I'm just curious to see how Twitter keeps, what other stuff they're going to be bringing forward soon. Like I know they're, I think it's like they're changing the shape of your profile photo if you have a verified NFT. So I think they're just because like there's that argument of like, you own this photo, but I can just right click save as, and now I have this photo too. So it's like, how do you show ownership? And so Twitter's trying to do that with their profile photos, where you can show ownership of your NFT and your little, like, I don't know if it's
like a digital frame or something like that,
something like that, so that you can prove like a way of verifying that the NFT you have in your profile photo is the actual NFT,
like that I didn't just upload OBJ's little NFT icon on my own.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, to the actual owner, which is interesting. So they're going to keep moving, and I know Jack, their CEO, is big into crypto and Web3, so I'm sure they're going to keep making little changes like that. I think they accept Bitcoin now for their tip jar as well. So it's going to be interesting to see how they kind of evolve over these next couple of years. And you mentioned OBJ's NFT, and I know one of your stories, Scott, was to talk about NFL's NFT tickets, I believe it is.
Yeah, like in early November, I think NFL launched their first soiree into NFTs, if you will, by doing a commemorative ticket, which is going to be at least one of the ways that they activate NFTs going forward. And commemorative tickets are basically just like, it sounds like nobody really has any idea what games are going to get selected coming up upon those games. So there's kind of like the unknown and kind of like fear of loss, I think, aspect, I guess, if I'm thinking about it from like a value standpoint. But their goal is ultimately adding value to like ticket holders and their fans through these tickets. But it's only a select few. So there was like the first game on November 7th, one out of the entire week's worth of games. And now there's another two coming up for the Thanksgiving holiday. One, I think, probably, is it, or no, 2 days from now, when Thanksgiving actually is. And I think another one on the Monday. But yeah, I just was thinking like, it's really the first that I've heard them getting into it. And then off the back of that, to your point, like you started to see OBJ take a salary in Bitcoin. And I feel like they're, you know, we're just on the cusp of how a lot of these major players that really can like sway culture and such like that are starting to involve themselves in this space. But what's also sort of interesting to me is I'm not like, although I'm sold on the idea of NFTs, I'm not necessarily certain on the value of them yet. And so like, how much value is this creating for their ticket holders? I don't know.
I think really it depends on like the game that those tickets are for. Like if you had the opportunity to go back and like if someone, I'm sure a ticket stub from like the third ever or the first ever Super Bowl probably goes for a decent amount, right? And so now you have the opportunity to kind of create that in a digital sense. And when it's digital too, like it doesn't weather, it doesn't get accidentally like folded in half.
Yeah,
like
it maintains true. It'll never get lost.
Original. Yeah, it maintains its original quality. So it's like, that's just in terms of like a one-to-one comparison of what they're doing with these tickets versus like the physical world, like that would be the closest thing I could see. And also, I don't know what it's going to look like or what the art is, but you could have the ability to blow that up now too, right? So if you want to frame it and have a bigger version of it on your wall or something like that, you know what I mean? So I think there is some value there. I think in the short term, there won't be a ton of value. But the same way, like in the short term, your ticket stub, if you go to the game this weekend, is probably not going to do anything for you either. But I think it's more of a long-term value creation for the ticket holder as opposed to something in the short term.
I feel like there's so many issues though with like IP legalities. Like people are creating NFTs and it's not clear what you actually own when you buy an NFT, particularly when it's an NFT of something that exists in the real world.
Yeah, actually, I'm not really sure the delivery format for those either. I didn't look too deep into it, like what platform and such are minting these on and how it's getting distributed, but there's a lot of interesting aspects to it. And like I also think about like kind of the adverse component where like if they're only doing oh so many of these, and like the reality is probably the regular seasons aren't going to have that much value if they start doing it for every Super Bowl or things of that nature, like does it really just become something to like talk about? Or maybe that like these early instances of it are more or less just a test for them to kind of get some like initial feedback from like, oh, how they're doing it, what fans are liking about it, what they're not liking about it, so that they can do it like well for the Super Bowl. But yeah, to your point, like I think they're doing this with Ticketmaster, Karen. So the IP, there would be a lot of even just like interesting legalities there, because it's tech, like a lot of the data is owned, as far as I'm aware, by like Live Nation, who's the owner of Ticketmaster, and a lot of those types of agreements. So like, do they also have like a technically a piece of like ownership of these?
Yeah, like if you own like if you bought a ticket and you take your ticket and turn it into an NFT, do you actually own?
Oh, like you were to like mint an NFT of it. I guess it just wouldn't like be from the NFL.
Like who owns it is the question, right?
Yeah, that's I'm gonna look into that more now, come to think of it, because like in any of the past conversations that I've had with Live Nation or Ticketmaster, seems as though they have just a pool of data from all those agreements with like NFL and NBA and such. So if it's in partnership with them, maybe this is a whole thing for the NFL that's more just like branding, and it's actually Ticketmaster, Live Nation on the side going like, we need to like jump at this and start like getting our foot in the door so we maximize RevOps.
I talked to a trademark and patent attorney and the feedback was basically like this entire area is full of like lawsuits waiting to happen. And we saw one of the first ones happening this week. I mean, Quentin Tarantino is creating NFTs for Pulp Fiction, right? And is getting sued by his studio. But I don't know about all the details, but he does own all of the rights to like sequels and sort of follow on from Pulp Fiction. So I don't know.
Yeah, I saw that story come out. I was going to bring that up because that's where this conversation going. Yeah, because Miramax, I believe, right, is a studio. Mm-hmm. And because they, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to see how that plays out. I think that could be a big precedent moving forward. You know what I mean? Like, I think it's beyond just Tarantino's being sued. I think it kind of set the standard for how this is approached moving forward.
Yeah, a lot of these, you know, contracts get very specific about things like, you know, what is owned by the author and what is owned by the studio and or the director or producer or whoever it is. And I think, you know, one of the statements that just kind of stands out in those contracts is, for all, you know, existing and future forms of media. You know, that kind of statement was created for social and other stuff that might come. And I think NFTs might stand in that. But we'll see where it goes.
Wow. You bring up a really interesting point, Karen. I feel like there's some like groups of lawyers for some of these corporates that have a lot of owned IP behind the scenes, just digging through like social and things like that to see what they can find now.
Oh, yeah.
In that instance, like what would happen? Because like, I don't fully understand how the blockchain works, but from my understanding, like you can't take things off the blockchain. Like once it's on there, it's minted, it's on there.
Public record. Ledger.
Yeah. So then it had Tarantino sold these NFTs and then he got sued and they said, you can't do this. Like there's no way to put the cat back in the bags. Like what happens in that instance? Like how does that work? And then if he is sued, like is that does the lawsuit then come out of like the money he made? I don't know. I just don't know how that works. And now there are these like illegal NFTs floating around that people bought that they can't do anything with. I don't know. These are just like general questions. Like, granted, I'm like a believer in NFTs in the Web3 space. Like, so I'm not trying to dunk on it, but like, these are just questions that I'm, as someone who's still learning about it, has about the industry as a whole.
Yeah, I think Naz Daily, I've been watching some of the videos he's been putting out on Facebook where he's been talking about the NFTs that he's been minting, but and somebody offered him like $8,800 for an image that he created, which I think he found kind of unbelievable. But he refused it. And I think it's just an exercise for him to see how much he could get. But his point was that blockchain's not going away. Blockchain is, you know, kind of the basis of all of this. But I think the ownership and the value is still to be determined for NFT.
Unless, I think they provide a ton of opportunity too, though. Like, I think in a Naz Daily situation, or like any aspiring creator, like if you create, like, if I were to create NFTs right now, like I don't have a huge podcast, but say somebody thinks it will be a big podcast one day, like if they invest and buy one of my NFTs now, like it has the potential to be like, and essentially allows you to invest in creators, if that makes sense. Because you buy an NFT early on a smaller creator and they blow up, their NFT will be worth more in the future and you're funding them in the beginning stages of their process. So I think there's a lot of cool opportunities, but it's definitely still early days and there's a lot of gray area that I think it's going to have to be kind of ironed out in the future.
Have either one of you bought an NFT?
Not yet. I've looked at a few, but I know like the one, there's one I was committed to buying, but then the gas fees were just through the roof when it was the mint. So I passed on it, but I haven't purchased anything yet. I mean, like the price isn't even now, like, cause Ethereum keeps going up. So like 0.01 ETH is like $400, right? So it's getting even like, it's expensive to kind of get into. So it's investing the money you're not afraid to lose, essentially, is what the advice that I keep seeing everywhere. So I don't know if I have $400 I'm willing to lose yet, but I keep looking. Like, I've subscribed to a couple of newsletters that share upcoming ones. So I haven't yet, but the biggest thing is also liking the art piece that I do end up purchasing. Cause like, not everyone says like 98% of these NFTs right now are going to go to zero. So make sure the art piece you have, you enjoy, and you don't have an ugly piece of art that's now worth $0 that you paid for.
I kind of feel like I've seen a few, NFT artists that are creating custom pieces for people, you know, so if you're getting that, then presumably that's going to be something you're really going to love. And
Harley CEO or president, Shopify there, he actually posted a story or a reel the other day on Instagram, and it was like he just custom ordered something. It was basically like a live NFT or video NFT that he saw some guy on Instagram. He's just like, I saw this guy on Instagram. He's like, got this great art. You know what I mean? To your point, Jacob, I guess he was just like, I like this guy's art. Like, I could really get down with it. And I think it was like a one-of-one commission project that he would have offered him. And he ordered it, of course, in like a Shopify, like,
you know, digital company frame owned frame, and all digital that frame.
Yeah, exactly. So
that it was well,
like
a
little integrated campaign for Shopify, of course. But yeah, like those types of things, if you have the money and like you're appreciating digital art, like, why not? Of course.
Go for it.
Or I saw Gary talking to like how it could change the music industry, where now like you don't necessarily have to go to the label. Like if you release an NFT as a smaller artist and you even get like, say you sell for $100 and you get 1,000 of your fans to buy this art piece, you now have $100,000 advance from your fans that you can use to take the jump to create your music full time to grow. And with the structure of the NFT, you could now make the royalties go to the fans who support you in the beginning and not the label. And so now it's like changing the structure where it's like your fans, your early fans get rewarded for supporting you and your success. So I think it's going to see a lot of cool changes like that, where like the future is going to be very much community based, where it's like you need just a solid community. And if you have a solid community, that community is going to get rewarded for your success. And it's going to kind of go around and around like that, as opposed to things like the label who could take advantage of you and they start just taking, leeching from your success, essentially.
Okay, well, I just want to jump in and basically say, for sure, I think this is a good time to talk about this post, LinkedIn post that Karen brought up, which was to say that like these communities that are growing right now, which will one day be in the metaverse, are apparently already demanding stupid money for virtual digital like billboards. Come on, this post just made me upset.
It felt like Second Life, and it felt like, if you take a look at the company that's creating these billboards, and I know I'm probably going to mess up their name here, but it's Somnium, Somnium Space. The concept is very simple of what they're trying to do, though. They basically, you bid to buy a billboard, you place it on your virtual land in the metaverse, and then you get a cut of future advertising revenue. And the large boards that they were putting up for sale were about $4,500, but then they had a bidding war that blew it up to like $69,500. I think it's crazy. And I don't understand why people are buying this stuff now. And I don't understand why you couldn't just put a billboard up on your own land in the metaverse. I guess presumably they're going to sell advertising space on it, but still just seems odd.
I want to point something out just while it's at the top of mind, because like just what you said there, like I think about the Nike land or whatever, there's a PR thing released over the past month about Nike building a metaverse with Roblox and like investing a ton of money into Nike land. And like, to your point, like if I was Nike, I mean, like I would be thinking a lot about what do I want that user experience to look like? I sure as hell wouldn't want other brands advertising in my Nike land. Like I would make it a Nike land. So to kind of take the flip switch of that, it's like, I don't know who is behind some of the metaverses that these like billboards will just end up in and where they're going to be in this metaverse land. But like, would that really even be the type of experience that I'm like hoping I'm going to convert on in the future? Or like, isn't there a bit more of an integrated kind of strategic approach to like how you might be able to, I don't know, advertise and stuff like that? Like, I guess this is one of the early versions. But it seems like to me that the experience would be pretty poor. Like if I was just in some land and there was ads everywhere, like I'm not going to use that.
Well, I also feel like it's sort of replicating real life. Whereas in the metaverse, to your point, you want to create a better user experience. And I would imagine that advertising, if it exists in the same kind of format, would be dynamic. So I wouldn't see what you would see because we're looking at different kinds of things. And I would hope the user experience would be highly contextual and integrated. I almost wouldn't notice it to be advertising.
Wait, that's what you'd think. Yeah, that's what I was like reading up on this. And then you see like, oh, out of two of three like little posts, it's like the cooler the experience they build, the more users it will attract, the more brands will want to be involved. What is the basis of that statement? Cool? It doesn't make any sense to me. There's no data supporting that. Like, anyway.
And there are times when I wonder, you know, am I just too old to appreciate like the metaverse? I don't know. I don't think so. I mean, I went through various iterations of VR, AR, you know, digital worlds. Some of these things just don't make sense to me from as a marketer, as a consumer, as a gamer, as, you know, they just don't make sense. I think people are just trying to grift from this whole like concept early on. That's what it feels like.
Yeah, like this is an investment for the metaverse as new brands enter the new wave of the internet. It's just like, of course, this is just another post that's like jumping on craze and energy and things. And like, anyways, yeah.
It just feels like there's infrastructure to be built for the metaverse, but I feel like it's more of a concept versus a destination. And I think those destinations will be experiences that are created by brands versus like land. <You know?
laughs> Yeah, well, you can bet that I'm not going to go on long walks, and I don't know if Facebook is just going to have a world out there or whatever, but like that's not, I don't really see that as appealing, at least for me. And I'm sure that there's probably about half the population who would agree, at least, you know, it's kind of like.
What I will say with the metaverse, I think like this specific billboard that was sent over is for what looks like Somnium Space, which is like a different, I don't know what, like it's going to be their own kind of metaverse. And I think, so it's not going to be in Nike, it's not going to be in Facebook. It's whatever metaverse this company is building is what it looks like. And I think even Mark Zuckerberg's talked about this, like the metaverse is, to your point, Karen, a concept. And so like, I don't think there's going to be like, and he says the best way for the metaverse to work is for it to be kind of all connected. So it's not individual metaverses. And
interoperable, building, right? Like you could carry your stuff with you, your virtual outfits, your tools, your games, your whatever with you place to place.
Which is not like a video game now, which is like you end video game, you cannot switch over with skins or whatever.
Yeah. And so I think right now, like the way, and I listened to Chris Dixon talk about this, and he's big in the NFT space, works for A16Z. And the word they use to describe it right now is like, we're in kind of like a skeuomorphic phase, which is essentially like taking when a new technology comes in, applying the old technology to the new technology to make people comfortable with it. And so like in the beginning with websites, they were just kind of digital brochures, and that was their skeuomorphic form until they became digitally native. So I don't even think we're like, because we're so early on, like we're in a digital, we're not at the metaverse native way of doing things. So now it's just everyone's kind of creating their own like virtual reality experiences essentially and calling it the metaverse. But I think we're still so far away from what it's actually going to look like. And so with these billboards in particular, like I've never heard of Somnium Space. They have 1300 followers on LinkedIn. I don't know how popular it is. Like, I think it might, part of this end, I could be wrong, but part of this billboard could just be people being overexcited. Facebook's changed their name. Metaverse is the buzzword right now. And everyone's kind of just jumping in and like wherever they can. So that's kind of my thought process on it. I still think we're really early and no one's spending. I mean, again, this is a long-term play because you own it for forever, I guess. So if Somnium does hit and you bought a billboard for $4,500, like this could turn out to be a great investment, but only time will tell, really.
It could. I think that there's just a lot of things happening right now where people are looking to jump on the urgency and don't actually have much of a purpose behind what they're doing. Their purpose is more getting free Ethereum and, you know what I mean? And yeah, playing this sort of world that's now open and people are a little bit more open too. So like you look, if you're talking about the metaverse being a concept still right now, this is hashtagging virtual land. And so like, I'm sure maybe that's a sub category of the concept at this point in time, but like, I'm not sure anybody really has the right to just be kind of like talking about what will do well and like how you'll attract more potential customer or whatever it is, like without any data really supporting this claim. It's just, that should be sandwiched.
And the concept of digital land is interesting because it's the metaverse and it's digital, because you just not keep creating and adding more land. And like, unless you create some form of like digital scarcity, because on the blockchain, maybe there's a way to do that. But then like, could you not just like build more worlds that you could buy? Like, you know what I mean? Like, I just feel like, I don't know.
Time
will tell. It could end up being like buying property in Manhattan way back in the day when it was affordable, or it could end up being buying land in the middle of nowhere that no one ends up going to see or visit. So too early to tell,
really. Or land in space that nobody's ever seen.
Exactly. I was just gonna say, I go back to what I said before, which is I think the headgear is gonna have to really evolve for this to take on mass adoption. And I don't know if you saw Gary V's discussion with Zuck around the metaverse, but he basically challenged him on the headgear. You know, he was like, he was sort of like teetering on the point of saying like, nobody's going to wear those. But, you know, he basically said, hey, like, do you think that, you know, these things will get a little less, you know, cumbersome? And basically, you know, what about contacts? Can we have contacts? And Zuck is like, ooh, like, no, that's not going to work, because basically it projects into your retina and you have to be able to see the rest of the internet. So glasses are kind of, you know, but I don't know about you, but I had spectacles for a while and those kind of didn't work either. So I don't know. I feel like the actual hardware needs to evolve. Pretty much everything that I felt like I saw in Zuckerberg's presentation on the metaverse was so kind of aspirational. It didn't feel like it's going to be here for years. And when Gary V kind of pushed him on it, like, hey, you know, the lightsaber that you had, he's like, oh, yeah, that's kind of going to be a few years out. And pretty much everything's going to be a few years out, at least.
Yeah. And I think where we're going to see a lot of it like initially is going to be AR over VR, like right in the short term. Like, I think there's some ways where you can start to do that. So I think that'll be here first. Like, they released their glasses with Oakley?
Yeah, I think so.
A little while ago. So it's going to be interesting to see.
But we know the gaming industry is going to innovate.
You're on point. So Somnium Space is apparently a computer games provider. So
of course they are.
But speaking of not seeing it for a couple of years, what we're not seeing at all anymore today is dislikes on YouTube, because YouTube removed it from the, like, you can still dislike, but the counter, the like count is still there. The discount counter is gone. And so people are upset because the dislike button's been on YouTube, I'm pretty sure, since the beginning, from my understanding. And it used to be an easy way to gauge whether the video you clicked on is legit. Like, for example, like, so YouTube is behind it saying the reason they did it is because people were like dislike bombing, and they'd go to a video, a creator they didn't like, and they'd all just dislike it. And that the reason they removed it is to curb that behavior, and not because the most disliked video of all time was made by YouTube itself. So that's what their reasoning for it was, to stop these dislike bombs. But creators aren't too stoked on it. Like, I know MKBHD is probably one of the biggest ones that I've seen speak out against it. Marquez Brownlee, who's a huge tech creator, is over 10 million subscribers, I believe. And he's just, his argument has been that, like, you used to use dislikes to tell whether a video is good or not without wasting your time syncing it into a 10, 15 minute video. Like, if you jump on a tutorial and it's got more dislikes than likes, you know it's not the tutorial for you. Or if you see a new movie trailer and you click on it and it's got way more dislikes than likes, you know it's a fake trailer. So it saves a lot of your time. It allows you to get a sense of the community's feeling on this video. And so he's upset that, and I've seen other creators too talking about, they're upset the dislike button or the dislike counter is gone. And like Mark has even shared on Twitter a screenshot of YouTube's Rewind, which has like, I think 19 million dislikes or something. And now you can't see that. It just has 3 million likes. And he goes, wow, this must be a great video. It has 3 million likes. That's incredible. Because you can't see that it's 19 million dislikes anymore. And so he's been very outspoken about it. And a lot of these creators, I've seen other creators talking about it as well. So I'm curious what you guys think of YouTube deleting or removing the dislike button or the dislike count from the public. Like, do you think it's a big deal? Do you think people just adapt and move on? Like, what do you think?
I mean, creators can still see the dislikes, right? So they know. And if they're publishing something that has more dislikes than likes, they're continuing to put it out there. I would say that's on them. But I do like the fact that it could curb the trolling. You know, I think it's that part of social, I think, is just dysfunctional. I mean, sure, people can show their dislike of something, but they can do that with comments too.
Yeah, big communities get together online to sort of what you might refer to, Jacob, as dunk things, you know what I mean? And that, like, so I think it's, there's some things that I really like about that move. What I didn't like was in that 3-minute YouTube video, whoever that gentleman was, he says in the first 30 seconds that, like, this is a big problem for us because our mission is to give everyone a voice. And while they do give everyone that voice, there's also only certain creators that reach heights that actually get monetized. And so their platform is inevitably, like, it's somewhat biased towards certain topics, certain interests and people. So, like, it's just one of those things where, like, you can't use those types of words to your advantage when it sounds good, I feel. When there's also things going on behind the scenes where, like, people are putting great information onto that search engine and actually not getting the same type of either rewards or exposure potentially through their search engine because of that topic that others would, that are kind of providing the same type of value for potentially a different topic. And so, like, I do think a little bit of that. And in terms of the dislike, Marquise Brownlee's, like, I guess the common sentiment behind it, I think that's flawed. Like, although it may seem like the logical conclusion to be like, oh, well, like, now as a user, you don't get a sense of, well, one, it was like what they're saying is proof that that wasn't necessarily always the case, that like some videos that were getting dislikes were actually good videos and that should be seen more and that they were getting sandwiched down in their algorithm. And that by doing this, Google should actually be able to create a better algorithm for YouTube and to be sort of like showing the videos that are getting either more engagement, more view time, like a combination of all these different things. And as well, they can still see behind their own wall as how many dislikes any sort of video is getting. So that should be factored in more of a blind way for the consumers and the experience that we're getting as we're searching for stuff, because it's a search engine. It's owned by Google. So, like, as a guy who's like documenting about tech all the time, I'm just surprised that you also wouldn't like speak about the other logical side to this, which is it's not about like always like, oh, now I don't know that this is like not a great video. It's like them trying to create a better product and a better experience ultimately for all the users.
That's a good point, that at the end of the day, it makes the search engine better because it's not being influenced by people who are just trolling and doing the dislikes.
But like, that's just logic, you know what I mean? It's like logic is based on like, what's the right thing to do? And it's like, you could look down this and go, well, it's wrong to like tell people now that like, hey, this video that actually maybe has gotten some flack, but like, you know what, scroll down to the comments and I'm sure you'll figure that out pretty quickly. Like, if that's your reason for using the dislike, like, if I get to a video and it turns out not to be like a real trailer, I find out because it's not a real trailer 5 seconds in. I've never once looked at the dislikes to be like, oh, good thing those dislikers figured this one out for me, you know?
Yeah, and I feel like, you know, creators are very focused on their likes and dislikes. I would agree with Scott that, you know, I give a video a chance even if I see that it has a lot of dislikes.
If we decided to click on it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Make my own judgment.
And hence the ranking system being very important. It's based, it's what Google's all about. Yeah.
That's a good point. I think though, at the end of the day too, like you can get a good sentiment from the comments and seeing what the community's saying down there. And like a really active community right now is Book Talk, which is just blowing up on TikTok right now. Karen, do you want to talk about that a little bit before we jump off here?
Sure. I mean, this is sort of something I've been watching for a while. The sort of, you know,
micro communities or whatever.
Yeah, the micro community on TikTok, but also just Book Talk, I found extremely interesting just because of its nature. I mean, you're taking something that is very, very old school, physical books, and then, you know, basically bringing that to a digital platform. But Book Talk's basically the hashtag for all the content that's pertaining to books. And that would be like reading books, writing books, and everything in between, like book reviews, writing tips. My favorites are plot reenactments of popular novels. You start in at this, like a TikTok video it seems so super dramatic. You're like, okay, is this actually like reality TV or is this, somebody's TikTok? And then it turns out they're just reenacting like the plot of a book, and it's fun. I think it's super fun. So I love it. I've discovered a few new authors that way. And some books that I wanted to, you know, sort of dig into. I think today the more popular ones you'll see are nonfiction, but I could see fiction, but I could see nonfiction and business books really kind of taking that over too.
No, I agree. I think that's my favorite part of the internet is like to your point, something that's so old school, like books where you think like maybe not a lot of other people are reading some of these books that I'm reading. And you can just through the power of the internet, find a bunch of people with aligned interests that you never would have met. You never would be able to talk to them had there not been TikTok, where you can kind of meet up and around your passions. I think that's awesome.
I love it. And, I went to VidCon a few years ago and Book Talk was actually sort of blowing up then as well. And it looks like it's just continued and continued.
And I think that's a lesson for creators too. Like no matter what you think is a weird, obscure interest, there's other people with those weird, obscure interests out there as well that you can create content around them and you will find the people who will watch that content and engage with you as long as you engage with them back, right? As long as you can actually build a genuine community, because no matter what you're interested in, someone out there is also interested in that.
This presents the same type of opportunities to like a creator that may have had interest in writing that they do to like, you know, creators that want to get involved in music and like maybe could like create an NFT. It's just like it gives you ways of creating content that like will scale inevitably because it's like it does work and it's a point that actually resonates with the wider community on TikTok and a great way to like connect with the feelings that your book sort of evokes and like those types of things. And have those kind of be felt before people even start to read your book so that they know what they're getting into. And it's like whether or not that's something that they're looking for. Like to your point, Aunt Karen, the videos that they have in this article, I hadn't seen like any of them. And just like the first one from like an author who's, she doesn't say anything during the whole video. It's just one of those kind of like, she like has like just slightly different like eye twitches and stuff like that. And it's just a couple messages that are changing, sort of like explaining a deep plot. And it's like all of a sudden it has you. And you're like, I need to visit this woman's page and just kind of make sure that she is who I think she is, or like, this is what I think it is.
Also like a sort of an extension of that community was librarians on TikTok. I saw that during lockdowns, like the libraries were getting super, super creative about getting content out there because they didn't have people coming into the library anymore. A lot of them have the ability for people to rent books digitally or what have you. But it was super interesting to see some of the content around there. And like, I forget, I'll have to find it and we can drop it in the links. But there was one library that's on Instagram where they have a dog basically like act out all of the books that they have coming up on themes. And it's hilarious. Like, I mean, how creative is that, right?
If it works, it works.
It was fun. Yeah, it was super fun. So, yeah.
So if you're looking to become a writer, think about some Book Talk strategies.
There you go. Or you could think about some Instagram strategies now where you could leverage the new collabs feature and you can share your post with other people.
With your readers and such like that. Yeah.
With your readers, right? Like if someone, like even again, if someone like leaves a review of your book or posts about your book and they tag you in the ability to co-post it, now you can like easily collect UGC from your own audience. And like, I just think there's a lot of really cool opportunities out there 41, to your point too, Scott, with the NFT thing, like if you build a community on Book Talk and then you sell an NFT of your future book and now your audience buys this NFT, which allows you to take the year off to write your book, and now they get royalties every time your book is sold, like there's some cool opportunities there. But where I was going with this was the collab post, Scott. I know you had mentioned wanting to talk about that briefly as well. So what caught your eye with it? Like, when did you first see it? Why did it stand out to you talking about the collab feature?
No, I think I saw it on Instagram. Like, it might have been one of those little stories or something of the nature. Either that or it was an article. But I think what caught my eye about it is just like how, one, I saw initially some brands that were going back in time. I guess like thinking about a conversation that we had about Spark ads, I thought that this was low key, and it could be way off, but low key a way for TikTok, Instagram to compete with TikTok Spark ads feature, but on an organic level, like give it to users, brands more specifically, I would say, in a way that they can almost leverage this if they have tight enough relationships with like their athletes or creators and stuff like that, in a way that's like free. Because what I did see was certain brands going back in time on content that performed extremely well for like an athlete or an influencer and things like that, and then reposting it. And I'm guessing the thought process there for them was like, hey, like, it's been like 2 to 3 years since you posted this piece of content. It's like one of your top performing pieces of content. And at the time, there was no like, you know, mutual way for the brand to benefit from like the engagement and such that the post would get, or like the UGC aspect of that, right? Like on the influencer's page or whatever. And now you see like the direct link between the two. You can go as a follower of the influencer, see that the exact same post is on the brand page, the exact same engagements and stuff like that, and potentially you're finding it on the brand page. You know what I mean? And I think like for in that context, there's a lot of ability for brands to sort of use the existing relationships and influencers and such that they already work with to get way more out of their organic content strategy. And then, yeah, I think that there's, you know, even some other ways that it competes with TikTok. Like Karen said earlier, when we were talking offline, like a bit of a dual feature or whatever. But again, it's like kind of just like a simple, more organic way I feel of doing it. I think it's a great, you're going to see a lot of different things start to happen. Like there's tons of blogs out there that'll just give you like, hey, 8 ways you could use collabs. So I'm not going to just go into the basic stuff, but I think brands will be taking advantage. That's for sure. There's a will, there's a way.
We've even seen on like an influencer side, like they will throw in extra accounts, and because it's just easy to do a quick co-post. You don't have to post it twice. You can just add your additional account. So if you're, and a lot of these big, some of these meme pages that we've worked with, they have like a network of accounts. So it's very easy for them to now upsell their other accounts, and they can do it very easily with the co-post feature.
Oh, wow. Yeah. That's incredible.
Yeah. Or like if a band goes on tour now, you can post to the band's account and then co-post it with the members of the band and stuff like that. Like there's a lot of cool ways, to your point, a lot of blog posts just that you can use and leverage for doing these co-posts.
That, and like to your, what you're saying is the experience too. Like it's actually getting better for all of the people who are using it in a way that like they're saving time, you know, a lot of the time now, I guess. And I thought that was actually a really good feature. Out of all the features that continually get introduced that seemingly don't have much differentiation, that was like one that jumped out to me as like shocking that they didn't do this before, but it helps them compete right now so well.
Even like from a creator side, like if you're doing a collab with somebody as well, like not on a brand side, but like just two creators working together, like
growing your accounts, like, especially coming off the back of TikTok where like people are typically sharing different types of content or whatever on their Instagram account.
I'm a fan of the co-post feature. And it's maybe with the podcast, like with guests and stuff, like if I tag a guest in it, like they could share it. Like there's just different options, lots of options with the co-post feature for sure.
I wonder if it has a little bit to do with like they noticed that people were getting a little less concerned about like what they're posting on their feed, because it's a bit more of like, not everyone in that way, but like, yeah, I think it's opened up a little bit more to like a wide variety of types of content, and it's not necessarily the aesthetic right anymore that's driving growth for these people. And so like kind of an opportune time to say that, hey, to your point, people might be a little bit more open to being like, oh yeah, this is an awesome picture. Like, oh, this is a great fan moment. Like done, post. Taylor Swift, I think Gary Vee calls it like the Taylor Swift thing, like in real life, how she showed up to like weddings and stuff like that. Like it's like you can do those in micro moments and like have that build your relationships with your community as well.
Oh yeah. Like if a creator with one of their smaller, like if there was just a fan and you co-posted with a fan.
Took like a picture of them at like together at like a concert or something of that nature. Like, yeah.
It's like a lifelong fan, right? Like if you co-posted.
Every other fan going, oh my God, if I do that, there's a minuscule chance that, yeah,
No, that's awesome. It's definitely something that's got me thinking now. How can I use the collab feature a little bit more? But we're running out of time here. So I just want to thank you both for taking the time, as always, every month to jump on the social report. They can find Karen on social media at Bond Jane Bond, or on LinkedIn, Karen O'Brien. I'll make sure it's linked in the show notes down below. Scott Birdie on LinkedIn, Scott_Birdie on Instagram and Twitter, if I'm not mistaken.
You're right.
So you can find him there. Everything will be linked in the show notes down below, including everything that we talked about as well. If you want to read up on anything, it'll be down there. If you want to follow me, find me everywhere on social media at the Jacob Kelly. Feel free to come and say hello. My DMs are always open. As always, today's podcast is powered by TrueFan. Thank you once again for listening, everybody. We'll talk soon. I'm just going to stop the